From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Like most pioneers, Reuben Kirkham was no stranger to hardship. Born in England, he emigrated as a child to St. Louis, then Wisconsin, and finally crossed the plains with his family to Utah to join others of his Mormon faith. But he wasn't content with the life of a farmer or a shopkeeper. As art historian Donna Poulton describes, Kirkham was a romantic, a lover of nature, and an artist at heart. She documents his passion and his work in a new biography, and today on the program she joins us to describe an ordinary man in extraordinary times. Plus, a new study finds low oxygen levels in the Jordan River. What does it mean for wildlife and vegetation? All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Compared to some artists of the time, he lived a quiet life devoted to church and family. But Reuben Kirkham was also a performer, and he was unusually drawn to the rugged beauty of northern Utah, and he felt especially compelled to put his observations on canvas. A new biography of Kirkham is out, and today on the program, the author of that volume joins me in studio, Donna Poulton. She is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art at the University of Utah. She's the co-author of several books, including Utah Artists, Painters of Utah's Canyons and Deserts, and a book on Utah artist LeConte Stewart that is forthcoming later this year. Her latest book is the subject of our discussion today, Reuben Kirkham, Pioneer Artist. And Donna Poulton joins me in studio. Dr. Poulton, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, the health of the Jordan River. But first, Reuben Kirkham. If you have questions or comments about Kirkham or the life of Utah's early artists, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Poulton, I understand you wrote this book 10 years ago, but it's just now being published. Why the delay? What took it so long to get it into print?
Well, what happened was I actually probably finished it about 7 years ago. And then, like many projects, you get involved in other things, different work opportunities, and it just kind of sat for a while until finally a good friend of mine, Vern Swanson, took it to a local press that he thought would be interested. I hadn't done anything with it, although I really had intended to, and they took it immediately, and it takes about a year to put into production, and that's why it's just come out.
You are an expert in Utah art and art history of the West. What is it about Reuben Kirkham's work that caught your eye, that sets him apart and kind of set you on this journey to document his life?
Right. Good question. Initially, what had happened is there were several artists that were very interesting during that time. Dan Cart Weigland, Alfred Lamborn, to be sure, and Alfred's good friend, Reuben Kirkham. And what had happened is we received a phone call from a woman who said that she knew Kirkham and she had some of his artifacts, and it turned out she had paintings, sketchbooks, letters, journals. It was a treasure trove, and oftentimes you just don't find that kind of wealth in one place. You have to go digging and searching, and all of this was in one spot. So that was enormously interesting to me to be able to put that together. Another thing that happened was the late Bill Seifert had chronicled every single news article from the Deseret News for like 50 years. And so those articles had just been filed. So I could go through and find hundreds of articles from the Deseret News and the Tribune on Reuben Kirkham. Hmm. And so all of it came together, and it was just kind of the ideal book to kind of cut my teeth on.
How would you describe Reuben Kirkham's art, his aesthetic? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a naive artist, well, that's what we call it. That's not a disparaging term. It's a term for an artist that's self-trained, who has worked hard, who has tried to learn, and as was the case, almost all of the pioneer artists were kind of naive artists. They weren't fully trained like Bierstadt or Moran, the other Rocky Mountain School artists with whom they shared an ideology, But nevertheless, they were important because they were documenting our time and place during a really critical time, you know, a time when things were moving and shaking and the landscape was changing, and he was important in that way.
His work can be found in the permanent collections of the UMFA, the mm-hmm. Springville Museum of Art, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Art Museum, among others. And yet, I'd never heard of him. Not that I'm, you know, an expert by any means, but I'd never really known him. How well known is Kirkham outside of the Academy?
Not well known at all. He's well known among art aficionados in Utah, and especially collectors. Collectors will put kind of the word out that if a Reuben Kirkham comes, they want to be called immediately. So you'll never see his work on the market, and he didn't have a huge body of work. A lot of it's been lost. Mm. So,
well, let's start from the beginning. Give us a bit of background about him. I understand he was born in England in 1845. How much do we know about his early life?
We don't know much, other than the family immigrated in about when he was 4 years old. So they took the long route over and came through New Orleans and up the Mississippi, which was really a grueling travel experience. And then the family really had hardship. And I put in the book that I think that if his father had known, if he could have looked into the future to see what would have happened, he would have got on that same horrible ship and traveled right back to England mm-hmm. at that time. Because they had a very hard time trying to find a niche, trying to farm on land that didn't pan out, and moving, and then always wanting to come to Utah. That was always their goal, but there was always kind of a setback, a financial setback, a physical setback. So we don't know a lot about him other than the journals of his brother-in-law, Thomas Briggs. That shed a lot of light on the family's circumstance. Yeah.
And the family, as you mentioned, moved from one place to another. Mm-hmm. Finally, coming to Utah, did Kirkham find what he wanted to here in Salt Lake?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And I think Salt Lake was one part of it, and the other part was his move to Logan. But what kind of set the Utah artists apart was that in the entire Intermountain West, there was no formal art training. There wasn't a center where art was experienced. And for us, it was the Salt Lake Theater. And that was built by Brigham Young in 1861, 6 years before the Tabernacle, 40 years before the Temple. That was because he felt the Salt Lake Theater was so important to the morale of people. But and the important thing also about the Salt Lake Theater was that that it was considered to be one of maybe the five most important theaters in the United States. Hmm. It was so beautifully built, and so artists from the East Coast came to act. But what that meant was that they needed drop curtains, and lots of them, because they had four or five shows a week. It was amazing. And so they employed all these artists to paint these drop curtains. And so they were able to kind of work at their craft, and they didn't have to go farm and then paint at night. And that was an important point, that if Reuben had moved anywhere else, that he wouldn't have had that opportunity.
Dr. Donna Poulton, she is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. Her new book is titled Reuben Kirkham, Pioneer Artist. If you'd like to join us or have questions about early Utah art, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So how old was Kirkham when he sort of discovered this passion mm-hmm. for art?
Mm-hmm. Actually quite young. His uncle gave him paints when he was quite young. But here, I think the work at the Salt Lake Theater really helped him. He worked with Alfred Lamborn, who was a wonderful person, a transcendentalist, very interested in kind of of nature and man and God and how it's all translated onto paint. And they would go off for long hikes in the mountains in the summer for months at a time and paint and sketch. And so, I've tried to trace his formal painting, who taught him. Alfred is the closest I can come. And when I trace Alfred's training, it's also the same, self-taught, wonderful artist, but kind of learned along the way, and most of it from the Salt Lake Theater.
And the Salt Lake Theater was more than a theater. You describe in the book that it was a social and intellectual center. And so he was learning things not only about painting and perspective, but also about theater, about music, about drama.
Yeah. Yeah. He played the organ. So he would often go to the Tabernacle and practice on the organ. And I think when the Salt Lake Theater didn't have enough money, and there was never enough money in Utah, he was paid with tickets, extra tickets. So I could see him always giving tickets away to different things. So,
many of the photographs in your book show Kirkham holding a painter's palette. And there's one where it looks like he's wearing a lapel pin of a painter's palette on his lapel. Art was clearly this central part of his identity. Maybe describe some of the tools of the trade that were available at that time, because, as you say, you know, formal education was really not an option yet for Utah artists here in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
So what was he using?
Oh, you know, that's actually a very interesting question, because prior to the train, and even after the train coming in 1869, when you could actually bring paints by something that wasn't a wagon train. You have to think, if you're coming across the plains on a wagon train, the last thing you're going to pack are paints and solvents and linens and things like that. So they really had to develop their own hues and their own oils. And they did that by, for example, if you wanted black, you would char a cherry pit, or apparently willows were very good. So if you put willows over a fire, that charcoal was very good. Berries to get red.
It seems quite primitive.
It's very primitive. It's very primitive. Ochre, you had to dig it out, which we had plenty of ochre, so there was lots of browns. Blues, you had to grind lapis to get blue. So it was very difficult. So if you wanted to paint a blue lake, you didn't. In Wilds of the Wasatch, which we discussed earlier, that's a green gray lake, because he didn't have blues to work with. And so they had to really improvise, and also use animal fat, sheep fat, goat fat, and they painted on cardboard. They painted on animal skins because they didn't have linen or canvas. And so, no, it was very, there was a lot of improvisation going on. The collapsible tube with oil paints that the French artists were using was not available.
Not available.
Yeah.
Throughout his career, Kirkham painted scenery, as you mentioned, and sets for local theater productions as a source of income. How did this practice as a scenery painter shape his work, his later work, his smaller work on the canvas?
Yeah. I think they had to unlearn a lot of maybe shortcuts that they took painting larger canvases, because when they painted these huge canvases, scale was important, foreshortening was important, all of those kinds of things. And so I think he really had to switch gears, and they would do that in the summer when the theater had closed. And you can see that in the work he was doing with sketches. He was really working hard on perspective, linear perspective, blocking in for portraiture and those kinds of things. So he was taking classes from someone. You can tell from his sketchbooks.
Kirkham seemed to love to play with light and that time between day and night. He loved that dusk time. There's one piece that listeners can see on display at the Salt Lake County Government Center, which you mentioned, Wilds of the Wasatch.
Yeah.
There's another called Scarlet Sunset, and another called Evening Search by Boat at the Springville Museum of Art. Maybe tell us how he used light to introduce intensity or tension in a landscape.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I think this kind of comes back to the Rocky Mountain School of Artists. And that school wasn't necessarily a school on how to teach, but it was a group of like-minded artists. And the idea was that God was in nature, and that if you searched in nature hard enough and looked hard enough, you would begin to understand spirituality. And so they used a lot of really bright hues, and so sunsets, especially the twilight hour of morning and evening, that was an important time to paint. You got, you were able to get really vivid colors. They drawed very hard-edged paintings. That meant if you saw a rock or a tree, it was painted inside the line. So there was no blurring, that kind of beautiful painterly blurring that you'll see with an impressionism. It was a very specific way of painting, and it was a way of looking at nature.
Dr. Donna Poulton, she is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art at the University of Utah. Her new book, Reuben Kirkham, Pioneer Artist. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Utah's early pioneers embraced music, theater, and art, and the painter Reuben Kirkham was involved in all three. A new book focuses on his life and work on the frontier, and my guest Donna Poulton is the author. She is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. If you have questions or comments about Utah's early artist or Reuben Kirkham specifically, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. As we described, much of his painting depicts, you know, very dramatic landscapes of the West, and yet he had this incredible urge to learn more. He wanted that formal training that he couldn't get here in the West, and so in the book you write that he decides to leave this girl that he loves to travel east and to learn from the greats, but the trip does not go quite as planned. Tell us what happened.
Right. That particular chapter is titled A Fearful Blackguard. Mm-hmm. And he's fallen in love. And he really doesn't want to leave Nell. And Nell is, I think, fickle, and he realizes that. So, but he goes anyway with Alfred Lamborn, and they want to go east to study. And usually that meant probably studying with somebody of note, but also going to museums and galleries and seeing what is going on and copying. That was a very important way of learning how to paint, is to go into a museum and copy another painting. About halfway through the trip, he's robbed. And first of all, I have to preface this by saying it took him 4 months to earn $100. And that was an enormous amount of money. And that's the money he needed for transport and hotel and everything for this trip. And halfway there, he's robbed by apparently a man who was a real desperado, had a reputation for being very mean. And he was left absolutely penniless. And Alfred didn't have much more money, and so really couldn't help Reuben. So Reuben had a sister that lived nearby, and so he went to live with her for 4 months while he could recoup the $100 and get back to Salt Lake City. But it was a real break for him, and I think very demoralizing, because what he really missed out on was the training.
And Alfred Lamborn, mm-hmm. continued on the journey. Do we know what he found, what he was looking for?
Yeah.
Did he find the training he was seeking?
You know, I think he did, but we have no evidence of it, other than his art continued to improve and improve and improve. And when he came back to Utah, he would get really important commissions. The Walker Opera House, for example, commissioned him to do the opening drop curtains and all the the art that was done in the Walker Opera House. And Alfred employed Reuben to help him. So that was a huge commission that really helped them.
So this deep friendship with Alfred Lamborn continues throughout both of their lives. It develops into kind of an interesting business partnership at one point. I had never heard of the Panorama Movement and this venture that Kirkham and Lamborn undertake. Tell us about panoramas and their place in American history.
Yeah. The Panorama actually started in England in the late 18th century. And what it was is artists would I mean, we didn't have movie houses. We didn't have TV. We didn't have any of those kinds of things. And so artists would paint these huge canvases, usually 12 feet by 10 feet, and they would paint a lot of them, maybe 60 or 70. And they would have different themes. Kirkham Lamborn theme happened to be across the continent. So it was all images of crossing from New York to San Francisco. And
it's a travelogue.
It's a travelogue, exactly. And they were enormously important. And they made a lot of money for the artists. And so, but they were a huge amount of work also. And there was always criticism, what wasn't in it, you know, more about what wasn't in it than what was in it. But that was a huge moneymaker for them. And so they had that. And I last heard from Alfred Lamborn's grandson that the that particular panorama ended up in Australia somewhere. So, and then Reuben went on to do the Book of Mormon panorama, which had been done before by CCA Christensen, which was a beautiful panorama that was actually on the cover of Art in America. Mm. And Reuben also did a Book of Mormon, and it was enormously popular. He traveled all over Utah, southern Idaho, into other territories, and that actually acted as a mission for him. So, because children could get a lot out of it. And then, of course, we talked about those character sketches. He would dress up in different outfits and act, and so he would kind of intersperse the serious messages with this these moments of levity that kind of kept everything rolling. And so
So in some ways, the panorama wasn't just your basic art exhibit. Mm-hmm. It was a stage production.
Absolutely.
And so he was a showman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He would go on and he would talk about it. And Reuben and Alfred sometimes would argue over who was going to be in front. Each of them wanted to be the master of ceremonies. And usually Alfred ended up in front just because he usually had a better set of clothes. And Reuben really was the brains behind all of these sketches. And at one point, the people in northern Utah thought that the panorama was a little bit too, it wasn't serious enough. It didn't hold the serious message. And so he actually took it to the Brethren in Salt Lake City and said, I want you to see it. So all the Quorum of the Twelve came, and they approved of everything he had done, but added a few more pictures, of course. So that was important, and that's really what was sustaining him and his family during the latter part of his life.
Reuben Kirkham, you know, you describe these panoramic paintings as huge, 10 by 12. I mean, that seems like it would be something not very easy to lose. And yet we don't have any of the Book of Mormon panels that he painted. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. You know, you hear these horrible stories of, I heard one horrible story in a high school where a Minerva Tiger was about to be thrown in the furnace, and somebody lifted up the picture and said, oh, you know, this is a really important painting. People just didn't realize it. And I think the other thing is they were so huge, there was no place to hang them. These pioneer homes barely could hold a 12 by 16 inch painting anywhere. So I think storage was a huge problem.
Hmm. Dr. Donna Poulton, she is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. Her new book is titled Reuben Kirkham, Pioneer Artist. You know throughout the book that equal to his commitment to art was his devotion to his faith, mm-hmm. to the Mormon Church. And I'm wondering how that mm-hmm. shows through, other than the Book of Mormon mm-hmm. panorama that we've just been talking about. Do you see religious influence in his other paintings of landscape or of still life?
No, actually not. It didn't.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, but I look at the other artists also, Dan Quart Wegland, Ottinger, and that didn't really show through either. I think really what those particular pioneer artists were more interested in was showing their accomplishments. So a lot of them showed genre paintings, pictures of the firehouse, pictures of the fire, you know, the fire station, the sawmills, the different things that they had constructed. Those were important to them. Rubin didn't actually concentrate on those. Although he did in his sketches, and I think some of his sketches are really delightful. Chickens at the trough, pigs at the trough, sawmills leaking, and those kinds of things. So it is interesting. I think it was more about what they had accomplished than really trying to talk about the church in that way.
You note that he lived this sort of itinerant life. Mm-hmm. He traveled a lot, and he was on the road with these panorama exhibits, and then he was off to do some sketching for whatever, and then he's back to show to enter a fair or something like that. And even though he spent a lot of time on the road, he really longed for a permanent home, and he finally found that in Echo Squires, the woman he eventually married. He created this home base that he always wanted in Providence, Utah. Do we know if Echo, his wife, shared his love of the arts?
I believe she did. Echo was a strong-willed person. Echo was born, her mother was in the Willie Hancart expedition that came across that nearly died, where many of the people died in that terrible storm. And she actually was nine months pregnant as they were traveling, and snowblind for 3 weeks of that. And she had her baby, who was Echo, in Martin's Cove, in the snow. And so Echo was a very strong-willed person. Her parents moved back to England when she was about 12. She was really actually quite wealthy. And she said she wanted to come back to the home of her birth. And she came back and married Reuben, and they had four children. And life was pretty good until he became ill.
He eventually set up an artist studio in Logan, where he began experimenting with photography. As an art historian, how did Reuben Kirkham's artist eye, how did that inform his picture-taking, do you think?
Oh, I think that was enormously important. For one thing, just creating the backdrops for portraiture, he could paint wonderful backdrops to set people in. And oftentimes, if there isn't a stamp on the back of the photograph, you can look at the tableau that was painted and identify which artist was using it. But, on the other hand, to actually look at his photographs, there's beautiful contrast, beautiful depth. He really knew how to stage a scene, to work with the rule of thirds, minimalize it in a way, to set people in certain settings. You know, he really had a wonderful eye, and I actually think his photography is among some of the best done at that time.
How many examples do we have of his photographs? Are there many still extant?
No, there are probably, that we know of, there are about 30. Maybe 40. And I've been scouring Ken Sanders, different places where you might expect to find, and I haven't been able to find any on my own.
Reuben Kirkham, you note in the book, had an extreme fondness for narrative, that his work relays some kind of story. Was this tendency always there, or did it sort of evolve over time?
I think it evolved over time. I always like to put this kind of narrative into two different camps, and that is the Scandinavians were trained to paint narrative. So they always were painting homes and people doing things and children picking berries and things like that. The artists from England were trained more really just to look at pastoral landscapes. But I think his work with these Scandinavian artists kind of crossed over, and especially in his sketching. Then he was able to paint goats under a tree or a man walking on a trail or something like that. So it wasn't pure landscape.
As you alluded to a moment ago, Reuben Kirkham had met an early death. He was just 40 when he died. when you have those kinds of early deaths, it raises a lot of what-if questions.
Yeah.
What if he had lived longer? Uh-huh. What kind of trajectory do you think Kirkham was on at the time of his death?
I really think he was on an upward trajectory. The newspaper articles from Logan at that time actually placed his last painting, which was titled Joe's Gap, as among the most important works that he had ever done. They said that he had.
Can you describe that piece for us?
No, we don't have it. Oh. All I have is a newspaper article, but they described it as really one of the most beautiful, and that he had stepped up to a new level of painting, and I think. I think had he continued, it's well known in art history that artists between 40 and 60 reach their real level. They really have the wisdom. They really have the technique. They really know how to paint. And so he had just reached that point where I think it would have turned for him. And then he died. So.
And you note that the art that he loved and the tools that he used may have contributed to that untimely death.
Yeah. White, for example, the color white, the only way they could use the binders at that time was to fill it with lead. So you have to imagine you're painting without gloves, you're licking your finger, you're touching the paint again, and all the paint had really pretty horrible chemicals in it. And worse than that were the photochemicals that he would have been plunging his hands into. And so his wife actually believed that it was his art that killed him. And I talked to several doctors about it, and they described chemical pneumonitis as a real problem for artists because it kills the cilia in the nose and the lungs. And the cilia are the sweepers of the air and the toxins in your lungs that kind of clean it out. And these kinds of chemicals would kill that. And so a lot of them really felt that he died of this pneumonia that was related to chemicals.
Hmm.
So,
having done all of this research for years and years, what do you think is Kirkham's place in Utah art history?
I think he will be forever known as the most important northern Utah artist to have painted. He painted in Logan, and that includes southern Idaho, that whole huge area. He painted portraits. He did so much work that I think he's hugely important in that way, and also in this history, it's what was happening at the time, who he was working with. There's all of this going on that I think it's a resource in that way. The other thing I was able to do with that book was, because there were so few paintings, it should be almost a complete catalog raisonné at the back, which means we were able to catalog everything that he ever did. And that included everything that was even mentioned in a newspaper article. So this is a good place to go to. So if you have a painting that you think is a Reuben Kirkham, you can go to this catalog raisonné and look it up. And was it mentioned in the newspaper at that time? And if this is a time when newspapers mentioned almost daily what artists were doing. They would say, oh, they just climbed Lone Peak, or they just went up to Blanche Lake, or whatever.
And I love some of the criticism that you include.
yeah. They were also very, yeah, that's true.
So is that why you wrote this book? It doesn't read like an academic textbook.
No.
So what was your goal here? Why did you do it?
My goal was to tell a story. I thought it was an interesting story. I thought it was a compelling story, a sad story of a really idealistic person who was living in really harsh times. His brother drowned in a river. His other brother had his throat slit in the Snake River in Idaho. I mean, there were always things that were happening, and life was really hard, and he just persevered, and he kept it all in journals, and that's something that we don't often have.
And is that something that you take away from his character, just his ability to to hold on to that artistic vision and the persistence at it.
Yeah.
That, you know, a lot of people may have just gone and run their shop and given up on the art.
That's exactly it. There were very few artists who could kind of hold the course. Mm.
Dr. Donna Poulton, she is the curator of Utah and Western Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Art, and her new book is titled Reuben Kirkham, Pioneer Artist. And Dr. Poulton, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Up next, what low oxygen in the Jordan River means for wildlife. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. The Jordan River is short, as rivers go, but it benefits agriculture, prevents flooding, and supports waterfowl and fish. A new study shows low oxygen levels in the river could hurt aquatic life. And joining me now with the details is John Whitehead. He is Deputy Director of the Division of Water Quality for the state of Utah, and he joins me in studio. And Mr. Whitehead, thanks very much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Also with us, Hillary Arnes. She is the project manager for this report on oxygen levels in the Jordan River, and she joins me in studio as well. Hillary, hi.
Hi, thank you.
Perhaps I should turn on your microphone. Let's try that again. The Division of Water Quality is inviting public comment on their report now through the beginning of March, and we'll put a link to the full report on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about the Jordan River, do you use the river for recreation or irrigation? What are your observations about Jordan's water quality? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get into the specifics of the study, I mean, everyone knows roughly where the Jordan River is in the Salt Lake Valley, but they may not know the role that it plays in our ecosystem, in our lives. John Whitehead, what are some of the unique features of the Jordan River?
Well, the Jordan is unique in the sense that it is kind of a major river within an urban population area in Utah. So, you know, it serves to drain a significant watershed, the Provo Watershed, Utah Lake, et cetera, and feed the Great Salt Lake. So it's a significant conduit in that sense, but it's also quite an aesthetic opportunity for this urban population that we live in here in Salt Lake.
People use it to canoe, they use it to bird watch. What kind of wildlife rely on the Jordan River?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's quite an extensive trail network along the Jordan, and I actually live fairly close by there and walk it frequently. And, you know, you see a lot of bird life. You do see some other mammals like beaver and muskrat, things like that. And I've seen red fox and deer tracks and things like that. So there is a population of critters, if you will, that depend on that waterway.
So what got the division thinking that they needed to measure oxygen levels? And what does an oxygen level mean in the context of a river?
Well, let me give you a little bigger context. You know, we are the delegated state agency to operate the Clean Water Act functions here for the federal Clean Water Act program. And we're required to, as part of that, do ambient water quality monitoring on an ongoing basis. And so we have a fairly extensive program that does that, that checks the water quality of all our rivers and streams and reservoirs and lakes, et cetera, and then reports every couple of years saying, how are we doing? And this is all built on kind of a matrix of beneficial uses. What should, for instance, the Jordan River be supporting? I mean, we know it supports agriculture because we have people irrigating from it. We know that it supports aesthetic uses because we have people recreating on it and around it, and things like that. So we look at the water quality values that we are monitoring from the Jordan, and we say, are these measuring up? And in this case, there are a couple, three things that the Jordan is not measuring up to. The most significant one right now is the dissolved oxygen levels. And so dissolved oxygen is an essential piece to any aquatic ecosystem. And when we don't have enough dissolved oxygen, you have either a stressed fish population or you don't have one because there's not enough oxygen in the water to support the fish.
Hmm. Hillary Arnes, how do you measure oxygen? Do you just take water samples and then figure out what's in there? For the non-scientific audience out there, tell us how you do it.
We have a pretty extensive monitoring crew with the Division of Water Quality that goes out every month and collects dissolved oxygen using a meter, a hydrolab meter, and it just tells you the oxygen levels. And as with humans, fish are going to need certain amounts of oxygen levels, and when they're too low, we're not supporting those fish populations.
So for the layperson, how can you quantify what we're seeing here? I mean, is it down a third? Is this a trend that we've been seeing for some time, or is this something new?
So our standards for the Jordan River, and it's a little bit dependent on certain times of year, are 4.5 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen. And when we're not meeting those levels, when they're too low, we have an impairment. So at some points of the year, especially in the winter, we don't have a problem. But it's when the system gets warmer, there's not as much capacity to hold the oxygen, and there's more decomposition, as in the summertime, then we're having the problems, and we're getting lower than the 4.5. Milligrams per liter.
So as the water levels go down, as more debris ends up in the river, that's taking oxygen out of the river.
Correct.
Okay. We're speaking with Hillary Arnes. She is project manager for the Division of Water Quality's report on oxygen levels in the Jordan River. Also with us, John Whitehead, deputy director of the Division of Water Quality for the state of Utah. If you have questions or comments about their new study about the Jordan River and the health of the Jordan River, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. So, John Whitehead, not good for the fish. Other consequences that low oxygen levels have on wildlife, on aquatics, on our opportunities to recreate there?
Well, I think, you know, the fish are probably the most obvious barometer. And there's the Jordan River is not a fantastic fishery, you know, don't get me wrong. But it does support a fish population, and there are other aquatic organisms that are the food stock for the fish. And those, that's just a whole ecosystem, a chain of organisms that are in the river. And a healthy river has certain varieties that, you know, we see that are good for it. If a river system was to get too low on oxygen, you might begin to see symptoms like odors and other issues. We call them anaerobic type processes, where, you know, the O2 levels have gotten down to the point where anaerobic stink, if you will, develops. And so people would notice it there. We're not at that point right now, but part of our job is to protect these waterways, catch them when we can as they're beginning to show some problems, and then try to, you know, restore what we can and put them back into good health.
You'll have to forgive my ignorance, but is the Jordan River a natural river?
Oh, yeah, it is a natural river, although we need to clarify for our audience that this is a very, very heavily influenced waterway and managed waterway. We've got features on the Jordan River that involve lots of diversions for agricultural uses. We have what's called the Surplus Canal at 21st South, which diverts, 90%, Hillary, of the
80
flow?
80 to 90%.
Directly to the lake. In the original setting, the lower Jordan River, where we have the oxygen problem over in the Rose Park type area, used to flood regularly. And it would be a nuisance to us in terms of people having houses and development there. But now we've diverted part of the flow. So in a sense, we've exacerbated the problem with our human growth and development here. You know?
Do we have a sense, Hillary, of how long this has been a problem? Have we been measuring oxygen for quite some time, and can we see a trend here?
We have been measuring that for a while, and in 1996, it was first identified as having low dissolved oxygen in the river, and it's the
96. That's some time ago.
It was some time ago. So we've taken a lot of data, and we've had a lot of information gathered on the Jordan River. And as we've gone on, we've learned more and more about what's causing this dissolved oxygen impairment. At first, we thought, like other systems generally tend to be that have a dissolved oxygen impairment in the U.S. or have a nutrient problems. But what we found in the Jordan River is that it's not nutrient at this point. What we found it to be is organic matter related. So leaves, trees, twigs, as they come down into the system, they decompose, and that decomposition by bacteria is creating the oxygen demand that is then taking away this oxygen from the system, from the fish. Mm. So we need to, what our study has shown and what's going out for public comment for the next 90 days or so is a study that says we need to reduce the amount of organic matter that's going into the system by about 38% in order to solve this problem and have enough dissolved oxygen again for the fish to maintain the levels that we need to meet the Clean Water Act requirements.
So when you say that, does that mean dredging? Does that mean seeing more work crews out on the river to remove some of this debris? And will that solve the problem, John Whitehead?
Well, the truth of the matter is that this accumulation of organic matter has probably been going on as long as people have been in the valley, okay? And so, no, I don't think we envision dredging the Jordan River or do anything quite that dramatic. But what we do envision is trying to develop a mindset within our population here that says, hey, I'm not going to throw my leaves in the stream or into the storm drain. I'm not going to take my grass clippings and put them down the drain.
Are you finding that's a problem?
Well, it is a problem, and that's not unique to Salt Lake. I mean, people are becoming more and more aware of the implications of stormwater runoff and what that does to our water quality. And so part of our mission here will be to educate and cajole and encourage people to do the right thing. And as an urban population, if we do that, I think, you know, we have a good chance of trying to address this problem.
You mentioned that there's particular buildup or whatever problems with the low oxygen levels in Rose Park. Is the low oxygen, are you finding low oxygen levels along the entire 51-mile corridor of the Jordan River, or is it kind of just isolated in pockets? Hillary Arnes?
So where we see the impairment is from 2100 south north. As you know, the Jordan River runs south to north. And so what we're seeing is the dissolved oxygen impairment at that 2100 south north. So the top three segments until you get to Great Salt Lake. And as John mentioned, it is where the surplus canal takes about 80% of the water from the Jordan. But that's where you're seeing the oxygen impairment. The system slows down. There's a lot less water. There's a lot more buildup of sediment in those areas, creating a greater oxygen demand. So that's where we're really seeing the areas where there's dissolved oxygen impairment. There's other impairments on the system in other areas. There's a temperature impairment in some of the segments in the upper Jordan. There's a total dissolved solid or salt impairment in other sections of the Jordan. And there's an E. coli impairments in other sections of the Jordan that the division is also tackling at this time.
Hmm. So a few balls up in the air when it comes to the Jordan River's health. John Whitehead, I guess the overriding question is, this is not a major fish tributary. It's a natural river. It's going to flow whether or not we do much to it. Why should people care about oxygen levels or about other issues with the Jordan River's health?
Well, I think it's a national mandate from the Clean Water Act that we recognize if we ignore these things, pretty soon we have the Cuyahoga River on fire. And so, you know, you can look back through our history here in Salt Lake, and the Jordan River used to be almost an open sewer. I mean, there was days back in the 50s when there was red flowing from the slaughterhouses. There was days in the 50s and the 60s where it was just raw sewage. And so, you know, if you ignore these issues, then you go back to those days. And nobody wants to be around that stink or that mess. And so it's an aesthetic thing where we need to, you know, take, I guess, pride in our community and say, hey, we'd like this to be as nice as it can.
Does it also present health issues, though? I mean, the EPA, are they going to come and crack down on us? What are some of the other consequences
Sure.
that we're looking at?
Well, we always have that possibility that the EPA could take issue with the way we're managing, you know, the programs in the waters of Utah. Now, at this point, I think we're in good shape with EPA. But if we were to ignore these mandates from the Clean Water Act, We could see some federal, you know, intervention, if you will, as to how we run things in Utah. And I don't think anyone here wants it that way. And so it's that, and also just what's reasonable. What's good stewardship? And I think neglect of our water ultimately will sink the ship, because we all need to use it, you know.
Did the results of this study surprise anyone involved? Hillary Arnes?
Yes. Like I mentioned, a lot of the rivers that have dissolved oxygen impairments have been shown that nutrients, excess nutrients, and the oxygen demand related to the nutrients have shown to be the problem. But this is one of the first water quality studies in the U.S. that have shown through modeling and through on-the-ground data collection that it's organic matter that's been the culprit. So we're trying to kind of invent the wheel here to figure out what other future studies we need to do, how we're going to collect more data, how are we going to target understanding where the bulk of the organic matter is coming from, so then we can target our implementation projects on those areas, whether it's one certain tributary that's having a big impact or if it's stormwater that's having the largest impact. So it's innovative, it's new, it's exciting that we get to do it in Utah. But yes, it did surprise us a few years back when we learned that it wasn't the nutrients at this point, it was the organic matter that's affecting the dissolved oxygen.
And John Whitehead, very quickly, you are holding a public open house about these findings in about a month. The public comment period open for 90 days or so?
Yeah, we're having an open house on the 21st of February at 4 o'clock at the DEQ office building. And our purpose there is really twofold. One is to educate anyone who's interested in this issue, and twofold, to discuss and hear, you know, concerns, questions, comments on the study. So we're, you know, encouraging folks to come out and participate with us. We'd like to hear from you.
John Whitehead, he is Deputy Director of the Division of Water Quality for the State of Utah. Hillary Arnes, a project manager with the division. Thanks very much to you both for your time today.
You bet.
Thank you.
And the Division of Water Quality is inviting public comment. We'll have a link to the full report on our website, kcpw.org. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.